begin by hearing just a brief section from the book of Acts, which the section which is assigned for today in the third chapter, the 22nd to the 26th verses, where we are told, Moses said, the Lord God will raise up for you a prophet from your brethren, as he raised me up. You shall listen to him in whatever he tells you. And it shall be that every soul that does not listen to that prophet shall be destroyed from the people. And all the prophets who have spoken from Samuel, and those who came afterwards also proclaimed these days, you are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant, which God gave to your father, saying to Abraham, and in your posterity shall all the families of the earth be blessed. God has raised up his servant, sent him to you first, to bless you in turning every one of you from your wickedness. We pray. Lord God, we thank you for the prophet similar to Moses who has been raised up also for us. We thank you for the incarnation of your Son. We glorify and praise you in this Advent season. We ask you to bless our worship together. We ask you to bless our studies together. We ask this in the name of our Advent King. Amen. Our speaker this afternoon is Dr. David Friedman. He is a native of New York City and had some of his early education in New York City. He then attended the University of California at Los Angeles, received his degree first from Princeton Seminary, then attended Johns Hopkins, and there he received his PhD. He has served on the faculty of a number of schools. He served as a teaching fellow at Johns Hopkins. He then served on the faculty of Western Theological Seminary in my native city, Pittsburgh, and then on the faculty of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He is serving at present at the University of Michigan, where he is professor of biblical studies and director of the Program of Studies in Religion. Dr. Friedman has received a number of honors and awards. He was a Guggenheim Fellow in the 1958-59 year. He has served as associate editor and then editor of the Journal of Biblical Literature. He has also served as editor and first co-editor and then editor of the Anchor Bible Series in 1969-70, and then again in 1976-77, he served as the annual director of the Albright Institute of Archaeological Research in Jerusalem. He served as vice president of ASOR has served from 1970. He served as the director of publications for ASOR from 1974 on. He served as president of the SBL from 1975 to 1976 and has served as editor of the Biblical Archaeologist since 1976. He has quite an impressive list of publications. I'm not going to read them because if I began to read them, I would be taking time from his presentation. He's going to talk to us this afternoon on Ebla and the pre-patriarchal era. So we're very happy, we're very honored to have Dr. Friedman with us, and we'll turn it over to him now.
It is a great honor and a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. Please forgive me if I talk this way, but it may help to speak into this microphone. And I'm glad to have had a chance to meet some of you and hope that after the lecture is over, there'll be opportunity for more informal conversation. In fact, the lecture is intended to be informal. Years ago, I discovered that it was not always easy to have a manuscript to read or to consult because, as happened today, the lights don't always work, or it has happened that I have mislaid the manuscript, and I thought, well, I'll learn how to speak without notes. Now, I don't know whether I have or not, but I have certainly gotten rid of the notes. So, and there's another indication, by moving this thing 12 feet, we managed somehow to cut off the electricity. But that only confirms what I've always believed, that slide projectors were the source of Murphy's Law. That's where it all began. I don't believe in the 35 or 40 years I've been giving lectures that I've ever gotten through a slide presentation that something didn't go wrong, and usually many things. And I might as well confess right now, the problem with the slides has nothing to do with the equipment. It has to do with the person who took them. I made one visit to Ebla, and naturally was not prepared for that because it happened quite suddenly. So the pictures that I took, I'll make one blanket apology and then let it go. It's a good thing for me that I don't earn my living taking pictures. Now, what shall we say about this subject? I must confess to you, and some of you have noticed that we've published quite a bit about the Ebla discoveries and tablets in the Biblical Archaeologist and the other magazine that we never mentioned by name. They've picked up from there, and the whole thing is kind of bogged down in a lot of squabbling, but sometimes overlooked that there actually has been considerable progress, and that divine providence often works in rather mysterious ways, as we know from the hymn, rather because of the terrible feuding and conflict between the principal parties, more probably has been published in the 5 or 6 years since the great discovery than would otherwise have been the case. So it doesn't seem to matter very much whether the principal parties are fighting with each other or are in full agreement with each other. The process by which new discoveries are made available to other scholars or the public seems to follow its own timetable, and it's always a bad one. It's always much slower than it ought to be. And those of us who've sort of grown up with the Dead Sea Scrolls are fully aware of the fact that now 34 years later, much of the material, I wouldn't try to guess precisely how much, but a very substantial percentage has never seen the light of day. And after 34 years, that's a lot. That's pretty bad. So that if we can say that even a significant beginning has been made with the publication of materials, that is a compliment to those connected with the Ebla tablets. Now, I want to make a few preliminary remarks on the general subject of Bible and archaeology. This is sort of working up to a valedictory editorial that I'm playing with. I have to write one soon because those open-ended assignments are now being terminated, I think, with a certain mutual gratification. I never doubted that there were people who would be happy to see my editorship and vice presidency and all that come to an end, and nobody would be more eager to see that than I. So I can now announce that as of June 30th, 1982, there will be a new vice president for publications for ASOR, and there will be a new editor for BA as soon as they can find one. And I'm sure they will. I think that most people feel that there is some legitimate connection between the separate disciplines of archaeological and biblical studies. That the combination, biblical archaeologist or biblical archaeology, is not an irrational or indefensible one. At the same time, we may all share a certain feeling that after 100 or more years of rather intensive excavation and research, investigation, and publication, that somehow the basic expectations or the initial hopes have never quite been realized. There is a kind of cycle that a discovery is made, it receives inordinate, probably excessive publicity in the newspapers and other media, and people think, well, at last, you know, finally we have found something that is decisive and direct. There's some link with the biblical material that settles some questions permanently. Of course, there are always those groups for whom archaeological discovery is either irrelevant or unnecessary and unimportant. Those who are already completely convinced and committed and settled in their minds at either end of the spectrum, the ultra-right or the ultra-left, because both sides have been singularly uninterested in archaeology and what archaeology can do in relation to biblical study. And that's because the basic question is formulated in terms of proof or disproof. Either it confirms or undermines the biblical narrative. And there are quite a few people for whom that is not a legitimate question. They have some view or construction or reconstruction of the Bible that does not relate to questions of historical or physical fact. And I think myself that in an ultimate sense, theological commitments, convictions, are not related to what a scientist can produce or interpret or say about almost anything. Well, if we describe ourselves as being in the large middle category, and I don't want to categorize any of you, I hardly even know you, and my own position is not one that I would like to label, depending upon the circles I'm moving in. I'm either regarded as very, very conservative, because my teacher Albright was considered very conservative, and I have been a follower, a faithful, loyal follower, but in other circles I'm regarded as a dangerous radical. So I think labels are not terribly useful, except when you want to score points against somebody who otherwise would not be so vulnerable. But I want to deal briefly, at least, with the question of how and where and in what ways and why and how helpful archaeological research can be in biblical studies. And of course, there's a certain imbalance. Archaeology, as you all know, deals basically with dirt. Well, in the Bible, there is some reference to dirt, usually in metaphorical sense. As you know, when Abraham pleads with God and is trying to shift the divine position on the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah, then there's this, he says, I am only dust and ashes, and that's, but there is some dirt in the Bible, but not nearly as much as in archaeology. And the real point of this is that archaeology deals, except on those rare occasions when something unusual is discovered, with the very ordinary, commonplace materials of life. What survives? And apart from structures or what's left of walls and buildings, most of archaeological research deals with pottery, broken pieces of pottery. Aside from archaeology, they really have no particular value to anybody any more than broken dishes have for us. The same kind of thing. And needless to say, that focus, that absorption with pottery is not by choice. It isn't that people went out of their way to be interested in pottery. That happens to be what survived. If we say that by and large 99% of the artifacts of antiquity have vanished, this is what's left. You might say that of all the things later, of course, coins would fall into a similar category, but the only adequate samples of ancient life that we have are number one, pots, and number two, coins, because they are relatively indestructible. Pottery has a dual advantage of being very fragile on one hand, so that the life of the average pot is, in archaeological terms, zero. That's excellent. That means the date of manufacture and the date of destruction are essentially the same, so it's an instantaneous chronological marker. Wherever you find any kind of pottery, that tells you something about the stratum and the time and so on. But once it's broken, then there's no way you can get rid of all the pieces. So we have adequate samples for those. But what does this have to do with the Bible? Well, pottery plays a very modest role in the Bible. We think immediately of Jeremiah's visit to the potter. But then, except for incidental or, the random reference to utensils for eating or some special reason like the widow with the cruse of oil, pottery plays just as insignificant a role in the Bible as it does in our life today. So that the two are not in good coordination or correlation. And if the archaeology deals with the ordinary, the typical, the representative manner of life, the Bible, on the other hand, deals with the extraordinary, with the unusual. And trying to correlate, to connect the study of things that are commonplace with the study of something that is very out of the ordinary, naturally, they're not going to connect very often or in a very significant way. So we duck what I consider the exciting issue, that is direct relation, by saying that archaeology fills in the background. It illuminates, it sheds light. And all this is true, but that may explain in part the sense that it hasn't lived up to expectations. See, all this is necessary and important because if the main objective of exegesis and biblical interpretation is to put yourself or put your students in the position of the original hearers and readers of the word, then there's a vast amount of this filling in that needs to be done. We have to provide the background, which was right there for the people who first heard the word. They didn't have to think about geography and topography. They didn't have to wonder about allusions and references. It was all in front of them. It isn't for us. The ancient world is still a pretty unfamiliar place for us, and archaeological research, along with all kinds of other research, provides that necessary information. But as I say, this is not terribly exciting. In fact, it can be rather dreary. The occasional burst of light on the scene comes when, through the accident, and I'm sure that there is some kind of mathematical formula for this, that out of every million pieces of pottery, one will have writing on it. Or out of so many nondescript artifacts, there will be one that is genuinely exciting. Let me give you one example. Out of all the seals found in Judah, in ancient Judah, you know, people with professional status or with family holdings often had seals, so they're equivalent to our plastic credit cards. Only these are made out of various semi-precious stones and are not only quite beautiful, but very durable. Well, out of all the seals or seal impressions that have been found, and these run in the hundreds, probably thousands, one or two or three have a direct biblical connection. And perhaps the most astonishing, the most important, not totally unexpected, is the seal of the famous, the most famous scribe or secretary in history, Baruch. His seal with his name and some other relevant information. Is it the same person? Well, technically it might not be, but it's got the same name and the same patronymic that his father with the same name, and from the epigraphy, from the writing, you can tell that it's from the end of the 7th or the beginning of the 6th century B.C. You know you've got a fix. And how does this affect biblical study? Well, not very significantly, I suppose, but it's nice to know that Baruch, and of course the existence of Baruch or its importance, never been doubted, but here is direct physical evidence. Unfortunately, as you know, most of these great discoveries are unstratified. Nobody knows where they came from. And no doubt they were found under circumstances which are strictly illegal, so you never find out. That's unfortunately all too true. One interesting tidbit about this, nothing more, is that, as no doubt most scholars suspected, his real name was not Baruch. It was Berechiah. It was the longer form of the name. We also know from the Bible and from other inscriptions, but it means Baruch was his nickname. This was the name, no doubt, that Jeremiah used when he wanted Baruch to take a message to the king or write down a scroll or something. And it's instructive that in the Bible this is the only name by which he's known. And we might think that the Bible would be more formal, that they would have the formal name and the nickname would be found somewhere else, but when you reflect on it, on the contrary. This tradition came down through the circles around Jeremiah or Baruch himself, because Baruch came from a very prominent, very distinguished family, and probably in the days of Jeremiah and Baruch, Baruch would have been recognized as the more important person, at least in terms of social status, no doubt in other ways as well, because his family belonged to the inner circles of the court. So a lot of things that can be derived from this, but there it is, a real contact, direct contact with the Bible. Nothing startling, nothing out of the ordinary. Well, I can go on like this, but at least it gives you a little idea of how we should adjust our expectations or hopes with respect to archaeology. It's still largely a hit and miss proposition. Why is that? Because of the degree and the velocity or the acceleration of destruction. Even when you have everything pinpointed, you've got the city, you've got the citadel, you've got just where, let's say, the tablets should be, then you discover that in the Greco-Roman period they gutted the entire thing, and the Greeks being great builders, the Romans being even greater builders, they knew that to build substantially you had to go down to dead rock, virgin soil. In any case, they cleared out everything that was underneath. And that's great for building and absolutely lousy for archaeology. Much better when people weren't so good, when they just swept the surface a little, patted things down, and built on top. Well, sure, that's what archaeology is. It depends, you might say, on human fallibility. But as soon as you get people who know what to do, they destroy the evidence. And that's why so much has been destroyed in Jerusalem and all the major cities of ancient Israel and Judah. Those that were rebuilt in Greco-Roman times, and most of them were, the central city has largely been gutted and the evidence has disappeared. Well, that's the break. But you can almost predict it now. Fortunately, there are still some sites, and there are sites that have been dug, others that will be dug, where the abandonment took place early enough so that this excessive later destruction did not take place. So
even when you know exactly what to do and where to do it and how to dig and where these things were, no doubt, because every citadel had its tablets, had its records. They had to. Whether writing preceded urbanization or urbanization preceded writing, they are absolutely inextricable from each other. They cannot be separated. Because in order to conduct any kind of commerce, in order to have a city life with imports and exports, to have any kind of transactions with other groups, you have to have records. And it isn't because memory is fallible, it's because these transactions are not literary or, they're not intellectual, they are for hard cash, ultimately, and then you not only need a written record, you need a duplicate as well. So Xeroxing is nothing new. For every tablet found at Eblen, there must be a corresponding tablet in at least one or two or three or 20 other cities, because this is the way they checked up on each other. There's no question that writing began in business. The literary use of writing was simply an extension of this device, and no doubt, for a long time, in many places, was regarded as secondary, that the oral tradition was quite sufficient, especially to convey literature, because you will want to remember that literature, what we mean by literature, was a poetic tradition in every nation of which we have knowledge for centuries. And it is my judgment, I can't prove this, that the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, especially the initial narrative, the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through Kings, for which we don't even have a name, but what is called in the Hebrew Bible the Torah and the former prophets, the Nevi'im Rishonim, that continuous narrative, which I put somewhere in the middle of the 6th century B.C., that is the first literary prose work, first major, so great literary prose work, ever compiled. So prose was used primarily for business or diplomacy or other things like that. Narrative was poetry. And much less likely to be written down, although of course could be. Well, I think by now I better show you these slides, and we will talk about Eblen on just a few minutes, and then we'll show the slides and then some comments. Eblen is one of these major discoveries, the importance of which is recognized but not fully appreciated for some time. And the basic cause of the problem is the system of writing. I don't know how familiar you are with cuneiform. Some of us were inoculated and then abandoned it as quickly as possible, because it is a very frustrating and difficult business. Over the millennia, the training of scribes, whether in the ancient world or in the modern world now, is a long, very difficult process. And in fact, just as in the ancient world, somebody who became a scribe for cuneiform had to devote his whole life to that. That was a profession, a specialization, which tends to distort the picture about literacy in the ancient world. Because it's clear, in cuneiform, where they used cuneiform, literacy would be limited entirely to the scribal guild. 0.1% or 0.001% of the population. In other words, total illiteracy. But that would be a mistake compared, let's say, with the United States today, which is only 2/3 illiterate. Officially, we're a literate nation, but in practice, I'm sure you all could document this. At a university like Michigan, which is considered one of the best in the country, the functional illiteracy is appalling. But it's all the same, and that is, in the ancient world, literacy was available at a price, which is why all the stuff in Genesis about the patriarchs concluding agreements, being involved with written documentation, is perfectly plausible. That doesn't mean that Abraham could read and write, or Isaac or Jacob, or any of these people. They had too many other important things to do. You'll remember that Ashurbanipal, the last great emperor of Assyria, boasts about the fact that he learned his cuneiform. He could read it and write it. But he was unique, and it's small wonder that the empire collapsed under him. Because emperors were supposed to be out there fighting, winning battles, conquering people, organizing empires, and not sitting in a library. And I mean that literally, because Ashurbanipal's library was one of the great wonders of the ancient world. So these are exceptional. But the problem with cuneiform is that until you get a handle on it, it's hard to read. And the reason for that is, as you know, first of all, there are hundreds of different signs, and these signs are used both for as ideograms or ideographs, so they convey a certain content, but they're also used as parts of words. We use loosely the word syllable, syllabic writing. But each sign may have 1, 2, 3, up to 20 or more different syllabic values. And that immediately poses a problem, which means that any combination of signs, three signs, let's say, for a word, the combinations and permutations are unlimited. And at this stage of the game, where a man like Petrarca says, now I read this set of signs this way, and he comes out often with words, names, places that have similarities or similar to biblical names, a man like Archie, who is Matthias' latest appointment in this, he will read the same signs, but quite differently. And you can't say at this stage, well, Petrarca must be right, or Archie must be right, and the other must be wrong. The truth is, nobody finally knows. Now, of course, on the basis of other tablets and other settings, different periods, you know what the range is, generally speaking. Another problem here is the Ebla tablets are older than practically all other tablets. There are a few others that are the same age or even a little older. But unless you have these controls, unless you have something to compare with, and for example, there are tablets from Abu Salabit that are published by Robert Biggs, University of Chicago, which have clear physical resemblance with the Ebla tablets. They obviously are from the same period. They're separated by hundreds and hundreds of miles. But there is at least one document that is not a duplicate, but very similar. At Abu Salabit, there's a big gazetteer, a big list of places, geographical list. And at Ebla, a similar list. And some of the items are identical. Others are written differently because at Abu Salabit, they use more ideographic writing. Of course, that's even harder to read. And at Ebla, they use more syllabic writing. So there are differences. But that, at least, is a helpful clue. So if you can read them at one place, that helps you read at the other place. Unfortunately, Abu Salabit is almost unreadable because it was isolated. Now, Ebla. It will take years before the stars are in agreement because theoretically, no matter how you read a sequence of signs, you don't have absolute proof that that's right. Somebody else can say, well, I think this value is better here than that value. And you can't say, no, it's impossible, because it is possible. And in the same tablet, the same sign can have different values. It can be used one way here, different way there. But to say that this is confusing and difficult is an understatement. To this day, there is an uncertainty about reading Sumerian tablets, Old Akkadian. The older they are, the more uncertainty there is. And since the excitement and the importance of the tablets hinges on a precise reading, a reading that will never be objectively proven, because for that you would need a transcription in another language, like the Rosetta Stone for hieroglyphics. You need something in a language you know, like Greek. You don't have that here. But in lieu of absolute certainty, we accept scholarly agreement, a certain unanimity, a consensus. If the scholars all agree and say this is the way this should be read, that doesn't mean that that settles the question forever, but it's enough. Because you expect scholars all over the world, there may be 20, 25 who are really first-rate sumerologists. If they all agree, then you say, well, that's good enough for us, we can go on. But that has not yet been reached. Now, there are a lot of things in the tablets. Most of the tablets, as you know, are simply lists of commodities, exchange of goods and payments and so on, the ordinary commercial transactions. And these can be read, if only because they're so common, so frequent, and the numbers, of course, can be determined, and the commodities themselves are not always. Some commodities, we don't know what they are. But for many of them, whether they're cattle or they're grain or this or that, it's not so hard, and that gives you the basic information about the syllabary. That if they use them this way in the ordinary tablets, then probably that's a clue to the way they use those signs in other tablets. But that's only a beginning. When you get to the literary text, when they have sentences and verbs and nouns, this is a very complicated matter. So when Patanato says that the city Sodom is mentioned in the Ebla tablets, you know that those signs could be read differently and are read differently by other scholars. For example, in the latest information, Pepinato says there's a treaty between Ebla and Ashur, the capital city of the later empire of Assyria. This would be a very important indication, I mean, of historical value, all kinds of things. Well, he reads these signs as Ashur. This is a new reading for one of the signs. It's a different syllable than anybody has ever supposed that sign had. What is Patanato's basis for it? Well, he thinks that it has the same value in other tablets. And Patanato is the only one who has gone through over 6,000 of these tablets. And that's where you build up this confidence that your list of values is going to be the right one. Nobody else has. But Saul Berger, who is the curator at the British Museum, and considered maybe the best or in the top three or four in the whole world, he doesn't read this at all. He says Ashur isn't even mentioned in this tablet. It's an entirely different city. And he vocalizes, he spells it out in a way, and he admits that his reading is a city hitherto totally unknown. Well, he's right. Who is able to say he's right? Nobody. Not yet. And this affects all those readings that have produced the excitement.
Okay, if I don't stop now, we'll never see the slide, so we'll do that. How do we do this? Turn the light off. Good. Now, of course, I can't see. Great.
I trust I have a pointer here, but it's not going to do any good unless I go up to the screen, which isn't really necessary. This is a very badly drawn map, but those of you who know the Near East will recognize immediately the situation. Lebanon over there on the coast. Syria, of course, has part of the coastline. And if you look closely, down the lower left corner, and right near Lebanon is Damascus. You all see that? And up at the top is Aleppo. And if you draw a line from Damascus to Aleppo, that is the main north-south highway in Syria. And it's all in the western part of Syria, and Tel Mardik, which is the modern name of ancient Ebla, is right on that highway. Could not be more convenient. It's about 30 to 35 miles south of Aleppo. It's exactly 50 miles north of Hama. So you see, it's a little closer to Aleppo than Hama. And Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus, according to Pettinato, all those cities are mentioned in the Ebla tablet. Nothing has changed. Well, here we go. This is modern Tilmardik. And these beehive houses are made the same way they were made 5,000 years ago. And these are the two principles. That's Pettinato on your left and Mattia on your right. This is a story all by itself, but if I started to tell you it, it would take the rest of the time. And I suspect I've already used up most of my time. So if you ask me a particular question, I'll try to answer it. Suffice it to say, they don't get along. Mattia is the excavator. He's in charge of the mission. Pettinato is a sumerologist, which means that Mattia worked for 11 years. It was in the 11th season that they found the first tablet. And that's hard work, lots of hard work. They brought Pettinato in just to read the tablets, and of course, by the following year, when the word got out, everybody wanted to talk to Pettinato, and nobody wanted to talk to Mattia. And that must be hard on anybody's ego, but if you add to this that Mattia is a noble Roman, literally. He's noble descent, and Pettinato is a Sicilian. Well, you've got built-in problems from the beginning. And there's always a woman in the case. This is Mattia's wife. There's no romantic involvement, but she dislikes Pettinato even more than he does, so that adds fuel to the fire. Because of what happened, she is reported to have said that she wished they had never found those tablets and would make sure they didn't find any more. Well, they didn't. There is Ebla. That big mound on the right, that looks like a natural hill, but it isn't. That is the beaten earth rampart wall of this vast city. The highway right in front of you is the major highway I talked about. And Ebla covered an area of about 140 acres, which by biblical standards is enormous. I mean enormous. 10 times the size of Megiddo, for example, and the other cities with which we are familiar in Palestine. This is a sketch of the city. As you see, an upper city and a lower city, all in quadrants. And the gates of the city, that's what Ebla was like in the, third millennium. And then there's an Ebla of the second millennium. That's not the one we're going to talk about. We're only interested in the third millennium today. And you see the upper city, the Acropolis, that's where the big public buildings are. And that's that Palace G, that's where the tablets were found. This is one of the gateways, one of the great gateways. This, however, is the later, is the second millennium city. There are only two at Ebla, and after 1500, there's practically no occupation at all. And you see, you go from left to right into the city. And that's one side of the gateway. The other side was robbed out. But you see those great orthostate, basalt orthostate, which constitute the entry. This is a And I won't stop now for detailed discussions, but these are public buildings of one sort or other, lots of temples. And here you can see an artifact that's been preserved through the centuries. That's a laver or a basin of some kind, no doubt used for cultic purposes. Here is a great ceremonial stairway that leads up to the top of the Acropolis, where, according to the authorities, the man in the picture is Jim Sauer, who may be known to some of you. He is going to be the new president of ASOR. He's now at the University of Pennsylvania, but for many years, as you all know, he was director of the American school in Amman. This temple is supposed to be dedicated to the chief god of Ebla, who is none other than Dagon. Now, according to the Ugarit tablets, Dagon is the father of Baal. So he fits into the pantheon as an earlier leader, and of course the name crops up in the Bible as the chief god of Ashdod under the Philistines. So it's not a Philistine god, it's not imported. Dagon is a perfectly ordinary Hebrew word, West Semitic, and the name of the deity, no doubt, a god of crops and grain. This is not one of the ancient artifacts, but one of the workers on the site, and here you can see the way the digging is done. You're all familiar with, I'm sure. They had 5 meter squares, just like everybody else, and had dug down considerably. And they were then digging, this was in the fall of 76, in the early Bronze Age material. This is a view back to the gateway from the Acropolis. And here, if you look closely, you can see the bricky material, the walls. Most of the construction, as you know, is brick. Stone was scarce and used only for special things. So most of the construction is brick. And here is the facade of the temple, of the palace, excuse me, the Great Royal Palace, which was not one of these courtyard palaces that we're familiar with in the Near East, but this had a huge courtyard in front of it. But it was the central building in the upper city. And there you can see the evidence of a conflagration, a big fire which destroyed the palace, and which Mattia associates with Naram Sin, the grandson of Sargon the Great. There are serious problems about the stratification, the pottery, the chronology. Mattia's chronology runs about 200 years later than Pettinato's. The big question is, do you date things by the tablets, you date them by the pottery and the stratigraphy, and somehow they don't conform. So obviously, work needs to be done, but it is the almost unanimous opinion of scholars involved that the tablets date from around 2500. That's approximately the same date as the Abu Salabi tablets. They are clearly pre-Sargonic, that's the chief point, whereas the palace seems to have survived down to about 2200 or so, and that is a difficulty. But it may be that the archive was simply, this is a dead archive, and these tablets are much older, and the current archive simply was destroyed or not found. Here you see in the courtyard this podium, platform, and in the foreground you see the big socket there for a pillar. There's another one just off the picture, which no doubt was a kind of canopy for the sovereign or his representative. These are other little structures around the courtyard. Here's one with a floor. Of course, floors are very important in archaeology. And then this rather nondescript room turned out to be the great treasure spot. You see those little holes, those are for posts. And this room, which is maybe 12 by 17 feet, 3.5 by 4.5 meters, that's where the great archive was discovered. And I'm sure you've seen pictures either in the Biblical Archaeologist or other magazines or in the two books which Mattia and Pettinato now have published showing what this looked like when they first discovered it. And hundreds, thousands of tablets scattered hither and thither. They had all fallen down when the shelving collapsed. But they were still arranged in the order in which they were filed. So this becomes a very significant find, not just because of the tablets, the content, but the way in which archives were organized. You see, there's been slippage here because the floor was undermined by an underground spring. Well, that's what tablets look like. There are four on this little table, and they're different sizes and shapes, and that was one of the systems that they used. They're very careful about the selection of the materials. The big square rectangular tablets were for summaries and summations of commercial transactions over a period of months or years or a whole reign. That very little one in the upper left could be a small message, or tablets like that, even smaller, were used in classes. A lot of these are so-called school texts, where were used for training the apprentice scribe. And as you can see, one that shattered is a little harder to read. Okay, I think we've now finished with the set of slides. I've got more, but I don't want to show them. And that gives you some idea. Now, if we can have a little light, I will make a few comments. What's important about all of this? Well, basically, for people who are interested in the Bible and the biblical tradition, there are three things. One has to do with the date. This is very early. Two, the quantity. This is the largest, oldest collection of tablets. The official figures are 14, 15, thousand, maybe 16 or 17. That number is very misleading. Of course, the bigger the number, the more impressive. What does it mean? Well, the trouble is it means 15,000 inventory numbers. What's that? Well, an inventory number is any object you can write an inventory number on. So I apologize, I didn't bring my tablet with me, but one tablet would be an inventory number. But if you drop it, you can make 40 inventory numbers. So what are 15,000 inventory numbers? Well, my good friend Mitchell Dahood says there are about 5,000, maybe 6, maybe 4, but about 5,000 real tablets or big readable fragments. So nobody's interested in little slivers, that's just for count. That's still a great deal. And some of those tablets have 3,000 entries on them. And each entry is equivalent, say, to a sentence. So you see, one tablet can be like a magazine. And this is a kind of shorthand system of writing, so you can stuff a lot into a tablet. And thousands of them, what that means ultimately is they will be able to solve the linguistic problem. That there's enough material here in order to settle the question of the syllabary. There'll always be a marginal uncertainty, but basically it means you've got a soluble problem. By contrast, let's say George Mendenhall, my colleague, I'm sure many of you know him too, at University of Michigan, has been working for at least 30 years, maybe 40 now, on the so-called Biblian pseudo-hieroglyphs. There are about 10 of them, that's all. 10 tablets. And they are written in a syllabic writing. But the problem there is there isn't enough. That if you had 100 tablets or 1,000 tablets, then you could be sure that ultimately the problem would be solved. This way, with limited data, the uncertainties are too great to make a decision. He believes he has cracked the code and he's got it, but he's never published it. And I think the reason is, and no reflection on him, whatever he does, it's a brilliant effort, but it may never be possible to either confirm or deny or correct. So the quantity here with Eblis is very satisfying. This is a major, major discovery, and while it will take time, because you have really to juggle all 7,000 tablets at once, because it's the frequency of occurrence, it's the places where you can be more sure of the reading and apply it to less sure places, and you keep correcting this until you finally get an inner coherence that satisfies not only you, but your critics and the other people. That is still not, has not yet come, but it surely will. The date, about 2500 B.C., that is extremely old. I don't have to tell you that. Pre-Sargonic. And most people think that Mesopotamian history, by and large, begins with Sargon, that we have some reliability. There are texts, but they're very hard to read. Everything gets tougher the further back you go. We are in the so-called early dynastic period of Sumerian history, which has largely been regarded as legendary. It isn't, but it's very difficult to control. And then you add the last factor, and that is the place. This is western Syria. This place is only 60 miles from Ugarit. And we know the tremendous impact that Ugaritic studies have made on biblical studies. Ugaritic tablets, first of all, they're fewer, at most a couple of thousand. And secondly, they're a millennium later. This is after the middle of the second millennium. And Ugaritic is written in an alphabet, which of course makes it infinitely easier to deal with. And in spite of all these very decided advantages, people estimate that maybe we can read half of the Ugaritic material 50 years later. So the prospects for Ebla are not, it's not going to be solved overnight. The rich, in retrospect now, make some of the early claims and the excitement seem a little misplaced. And I can plead guilty here along with some others. A certain naivety, but the real problem is with people like Pettinato and Mattier. Mattier has his own political reasons for manipulating the data. There's no question about that. And it has to do with personal ambition, it has to do with relations with the Syrians, because politics in Syria is a very complicated matter. These people at the top are quite sophisticated. So what they do is not irrational, they don't have irrational reactions, but it's all calculated. And the main calculation in a country like Syria is that at the top you have a tiny minority group. Assad and his henchmen are all members of the so-called Alawite Muslim group, about 10% of the population, which immediately means that they're very vulnerable and are constantly targets of assassination and rebellion. The great majority in Syria are Sunni. That's the prevailing form of Islam. The Alawites spun off in the Middle Ages sometime. But these people are very sensitive, and of course you have constant trouble in Syria just because of this difference, quite apart from their real economic and other problems. You have the fact that most of the people resent their overlords. And that means that any excuse that can be used to show that the people in power are less hostile to Israel than the people underneath could be enough to overthrow them. So the Ebla tablets proved to be a political excuse. That as soon as word got out that the names of people in the Ebla tablets were the same or similar to the names of people in the Bible and place names and things like that, then these authorities could be accused of tolerating pro-Zionist sentiment. The thing is absurd on the face of it, That doesn't matter, and they know that. It isn't as though they were fooled by their own propaganda. On the contrary, it's simply that a lot of people in Syria are illiterate, and on the other hand, they're all very anti-Israel. So it would be unthinkable that here, in a perfectly respectable Syrian location, Ebla, you find tablets that are more Syrian than the Syrians themselves, and been there a lot longer. And how could a perfectly decent Syrian tablet even have the word Israel on it? Well, it's impossible. And anybody who says that is clearly an agent of the Israelis. Well, that's why Petanata got thrown out of Syria. Precisely. He was accused of being pro-Zionist. I can tell you, he is not. He is very anti-Zionist. That has nothing to do with it. But Mattier was very eager to get rid of Petanata. So he played along. So ugly little things like that happen. And of course, that interferes with the proper study of material, which is hard enough to begin with. In fact, it is so difficult, there are really very few people who have a handle on this material, and the sumerologists themselves. It's quite clear. Most of them want Petanata to make all the mistakes. And then they will follow along and correct them. This is true in all our fields, but especially in this cuneiform business, where the controls are lacking. Petanata is brave, he's fast, he's quite good about in copying, and his ideas are not all that bad, but of course he's bound to make innumerable mistakes, as he already has. But others following, of course, can improve on this. It'll take time, but as long as this political element is injected into it, it made it that much harder. Because I said Petanata was inclined to read names that sound biblical. Because he had training as a seminarian, and also it is clear that those who read this as proto-Akkadian, as old Akkadian, are not getting very far with it. And those who read it as proto-Canaanite are getting further with it. But they may be all wrong. That's a problem we can't resolve. Anyway, the period is extremely important because we know so little. If this geographic list turns out to be a list of places, including maybe 80 or 100 in Palestine, it will be the oldest gazetteer that we have by far. That in the middle of the third millennium, you already have a list of names of places that are in the Bible and also familiar to us to this day. So the period is extremely important. We have always supposed that this was pre-patriarchal. 2500 is much older even than Archbishop Usher's dates for the patriarch. And Albright used to say that he thought there was some historical basis, that is, some reality in the primeval story, that the Tower of Babel, he believed, was not related to Hammurabi's great temple at Babylon, but Sargon the Great, which would take you back to the 24th century. But here we're even older than that. And therefore, any possible direct link between the Ebla tablets and the Bible would require a radical rethinking of the whole biblical story. And because of the data, the evidence that Petanata provided to me, I thought this was in fact the case. Now, since Petanata, like Mattier, has his own political reasons and is basically unreliable, you can't tell. But he insists, and now even Archie agrees, that the name Sidamu, that's the one residue that remains. Everybody agrees that a name that can be equated linguistically with biblical Sodom, Hebrew Sodom, Greek Sodoma, that this is the same. The same name. Is it the same place? Well, Petanata says yes, and Archie says no. I don't think either of them can prove the case. because these are found in tablets, and it's hard to tell whether the transaction involved can determine whether the distance is great or small from Ebla. According to Archie, all the cities mentioned in the same context are close to Ebla. Therefore, this one must be. Tetsunaka says that the controlling factor is different, that it's the commodity that's involved, whether it comes from near or far, and that in some cases the context indicates a certain direction. Well, all these have to be worked out only when independent other scholars study and are able to reach conclusions. Not possible. What is significant in my judgment, and this will be, we'll probably have to limit it to this example, is the name itself. The name is given in three different ways by in the tablets according to the scholar. It's written as Sidamu, which could come out biblical Sodom very easily by ordinary linguistic changes with which we're familiar. Simply a matter of the accent. If the accent's on the second syllable, then this A vowel can become O, and the E vowel, the pretonic vowel, be reduced to schwa. But then it is also written as Saduma and also as Sadam. And in every case, the Hebrew Sodom would be Kibset. Now, are there three different cities in the Ebla tablet? It seems so. Not clear. Are any of them the biblical city? That's unclear too. What can be said? So far as I am aware, the name Sada, or any form of it, that is with the S, the G, and the M, has never turned up in any second or first millennium tablet or inscription. That the name is simply unknown outside of the Bible until this occurrence at Ebla. What does that mean? It means that for the first time we know that it's a real name of a real city. Now, furthermore, it is an old name. It's a third millennium name. And since the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah places these cities way, way back, and when the prophets talk about this, it is clear they're talking about an event, the destruction of the cities, which occurred in prehistoric times, that is, before Israel ever existed. This has nothing directly to do with Israel. In fact, it's a kind of coincidence that what makes Sodom and Gomorrah important in the Bible is the connection with Abraham. Except for Abraham and Lot, who actually lived there, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah would have no biblical significance whatever. And that immediately suggests that this evidence from Ebla is really important, even if it's minimal. We say no more than the fact that in the third millennium, this name was a name for a city. What happened in the second and first millennia? Because lots of these names go right down. Well, that seems, to me at least, to tie in with the notion that not only was that city destroyed, but what is very clear from the biblical account, it was destroyed in a spectacular manner, and it was never rebuilt. The Zeta name will stop. It won't be used partly out of superstition. You don't want to use a name like that if it's connected with that kind of an outcome. That's one thing. And the other is that how many cities with that name would there have been? Well, the more cities with that name, the less likely this would happen. If there was one major Sodom, which was violently destroyed, which was perceived to be a terrible example of divine judgment, then that would help to explain, first, why the name disappeared, and second, why the biblical tradition is what it is. So I think that the story is not yet over, and that Ebla has already contributed significantly. Now there's another side to this, which is not related to Ebla at all, except the fact that Ebla was in commercial, had a commercial connection with at least one or more cities named Sodom, wherever they are. We know from the Bible approximately where these cities were thought to be, the cities of the plain. And if you read the evidence in Genesis 10 and 14 and 18 and 19, it is in the vicinity of the Dead Sea. That much seems clear. Right around the Dead Sea. And of course, that area has been explored. First by Albright, 60 years ago. And his observations are still the most valuable. Have largely been confirmed by archaeological research. We are publishing at ASOR another annual on the excavations at Bab el-Dra. But what's the picture? Well, the first problem is where? And as you know, there are five possibilities. North, south, east, west, and under. All have been examined. And the best chance, and I think this fits the biblical account better than any of the others, is the east side of the Jordan. You remember when Lot escaped and into the cave with his daughters, and they produced these children. Who are they? Ammon and Moab. Well, that's all east of the Jordan. So I think it's an east Jordanian tradition. But in any case, that's where Bab el-Dra and Numaira and the other cities of the plain are. They're east, south, the southeast quadrant of the Dead Sea region. And what is the archaeological evidence? Well, right now, as you know, there is massive evidence of real cities in the early Bronze Age, third millennium. EB3 is the common period when all of them flourished. Well, is it pure coincidence that Ebla flourished in EB3? And we are talking precisely about the period of the tablet. Now that is the archaeological evidence. There is some scattered evidence for a Middle Bronze Age. There's something there, some pottery. No structure, no city, nothing. The picture is that from the EB4 maybe, but this is still no later than 2300, 2200 BC, from then until the Byzantine period. 5th century, 6th century AD, there is no occupation, no urban occupation of that area at all. So now it looks, this was always true, Albright knew this too, and so did DeVoe, but they try to fudge it a little, because they believe the patriarchs belonged to the Middle Bronze Age, 1800, 1900. Well, these cities were destroyed at least 300 or 400 years earlier. That's clear. And I think they fit the Ebla picture much better. Then the question is the connection with the patriarch historical, or was that a mistake? That is, it was so far back that the traditions got confused. Well, I find it hard to believe that this stuff would have got into the Bible at all, except for the connection. That if without Abraham, why does the destruction of this city or that city mean anything? Destruction of cities is the most common thing in the ancient world at all. Well, that's the crux, the nub of it. Now, when Petronato told me that in the tablet that mentioned these cities, there was also the name of the king, and when he wrote the name out for me, it turned out to be identical with one of the kings in Genesis 14, I regarded that as decisive. This was the smoking pistol. And since then, he has retracted it, but he has never explained it, because the reading he gave is very simple. Obviously, the signs could be read a different way, but he has never indicated what the signs were, or why he read them the way they did, or why he now thinks they should be read differently. That's what honest procedure would come up with. So I understand from another source that he is holding this back until he can get Archie positioned for a death blow. Then he will say, well, this imbecile doesn't understand Sumerian at all. Here it is. Like that. Well, maybe that's enough for now. If you have questions or comments, I'll be glad to.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. When two Pittsburghers get together, they always talk about smoke and fog, and this afternoon was no exception. We spoke for just a few minutes before Dr. Friedman's presentation, and we both agreed that the situation in Pittsburgh improved after both of us left. But I think that today he's lifted a little bit of the fog and smog from Ebla and for most of us. He agreed that he will answer a few questions, respond to a few comments. So it's open for that.
Yes.
How accessible are they, the tablets? I understand the Syrian government has control over them.
Oh, yes.
And has the Syrian government limited further excavation? And what percentage of the site has been excavated?
Well, in order, the standard procedure in all of the Near Eastern countries now, in most countries, is that any finds belong to a government, to the nation, and anything important or unique, like the tablets, will remain in Syria. They are in the museum in Aleppo, in the basement, and access is very limited. I believe that Mattia is the one who decides, but this also is in accordance with standard practice. The tablets themselves are largely unnecessary. They are made so well and they're done so beautifully that photographs are good enough for at least 95% of the reading. There are a few things on the edges or, you know, some problems where examination of the original might be desirable. But for all immediate purposes, pictures are very good, and I've seen them. Pettinato has pictures of about 1,000 tablets. That's all, and he's been cut off. But those 1,000 will take him decades to do anyway, so he's got enough. Mattia has control of the material, and he limits access to his colleague, Archie, who's doing the basic work for Mattia, and that gives us two people who are now working not only independently, but in a hostile sense, which is, from a scholarly point of view, is excellent. There's no collision here. We get independent presentations. That's excellent. And then there's this international team of 8 scholars appointed by Mattia. And presumably, since each one has been assigned a particular collection of materials, certain categories to publish, that pictures are provided them as well. Now, none of them has published anything yet, or very little. But in time, that will help also. Now, Mattia has been digging every year since, just as he started in 64 and has been digging every year. I haven't been back, but I understand that progress has been made and a lot more site. The site is so large that they'll never dig at all. They'll dig maybe 5%. But in cities like that, you know where to go by and large. And it looks now as though they have made the major discovery, and that not much more is to be expected. Yes?
Do you want to comment on the possibility of Yah as a field
work? This has been one of the hottest debates, and I don't feel qualified to judge what I think is a critical factor. There is no independent god Yahweh at Ebla, that is clear. In the tablets that give the sacrifices and the pantheon, he's not listed. The element only occurs in names, in personal names. So, and the form, Yah, at the end of a name, that's one of these questionable items. This is a typical ending, which could be an abbreviated ending, so-called hypocharistic ending, for almost any divine name. And it's just not clear. In a Phoenician, it would come out as just the ending I, which is quite common. And nobody supposed that has anything to do with the biblical deity. So that itself is not decisive evidence. On the other hand, when you have names, on the one hand, Mikhail, which is exactly the same the biblical Michael, and also Micaiah, which is the same as Micaiah in the Bible, you would like to think that the same evidence has the same explanation. So that's a factor on the other side. In addition to this, there is the prefix form Yah with the Dindir sign, that is the sign of the divinity. And there the argument is the reading Yah. It can also be the reading Eel, and also the reading Me. There are all kinds of syllabic baggies, and naturally it is Petanaka and Dahud who say it's Yah, and the others say no, it isn't. And part of the argument is that in Old Akkadian you don't have that value, and in presumably in Western you would have that value. So that the argument becomes circular. If you believe it's this kind of a dialect, you read it this way, and if you believe it isn't, you read it the other way. And right now, each one just says the other is wrong. And I don't know how to get into that. Then there is this other form, which is pronounced Ya-U. But there again, the big question is whether the reading Ya is correct. Right now, the most I would say is it's possible. I don't think we better say any more than that.
Any questions?
Yes.
No. Is there any evidence that we know of that the year is a living language there after about the end of the third millennium?
Oh, no. It doesn't even appear to be a living language in the middle of the third millennium. At Ebla. The native language, according to Petanaka, seems clearly to be Semitic. The scribes, in order to use the system, had to know Sumerian. But the way in which the bilingual glossaries are set up, many of the tablets are clearly for the benefit of the scribes. Here, as you know, the ideogram, the pictogram is given, and then below it is given the syllabic equivalent in Semitic. Now, in a very few cases, they give first the ideogram, then they give the equivalent in phonetic Sumerian. That's very rare. Then they give it in syllabic Semitic. But normally, they only give two, showing it's the Semitic value that they're interested in.
In other words, outside of the Semitic text, so the
Sumerian goes. Yeah, now, the other side of it is that when the texts are written in ideograms, the assumption is it's all Sumerian. So it's clear that the scribes are using Sumerian, but it seems to be strictly among scribes, and that the local population is Semitic.
Well, Dr. Friedman, again, we thank you. We're looking forward to what you have to share with us and with our students tomorrow morning. So, thank you for being with us.